Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
I'm Jo Pryor, and with me in the Escape Pod today, I have my co-host Mark Adams, who's multitask functioning with the panel.
That's
Mark,
correct.
How
it's
are
like
you this
the
afternoon?
Here.
It is.
I feel like the new doctor.
Well, I'm looking forward to you doing a Peter Capaldi impersonation.
What the f- We don't have a bleep button.
No, we don't
so
have a dumb button.
Sweeties. We do have a fabulous guest who is going to take us for a journey and not through space and time.
Correct. But what's been happening this week in Melbourne, other than, dare I say, being terribly English and discussing the weather? It's winter.
I haven't done a huge amount this week. It's just normal for me. I've travelled to Geelong and back.
Well, there you go.
I know.
On that straight piece of road.
Yeah. Well, I nearly got blown off the West Gate yesterday, so that was a travel experience I wasn't looking forward to and narrowly avoid having. But there was a car in front of me with a Greyhound trailer on the back that experienced a gust of wind somewhere near Lara, and I thought they were going to lose the trailer with the dogs in it at one stage. So it was very windy yesterday and not a good day to be out in a car. I heard that there was some damage. If you've had any interesting experiences with that, let us know. SMS us on 0427 Joy 949 or email us on air@joy.org.au. Joe, we've got a guest in the studio.
We do. Today's guest is Tim Richards. And as some of our listeners will already be aware, Tim is quite an accomplished travel writer, both freelance and also for the publication that all of us have in our bookcase, The Lonely Planet Guides, with a specialisation in Poland and developing apps and tips for packing. Tim, welcome to the Escape Pod.
Hi, good to be here.
Interestingly enough, that sounds like a whole heap of baggage you take with you, and you're a specialist at travelling light.
Ah, yes, yes.
You see where I went there?
As long as the baggage is digital or psychological, it's okay. You know, that packs away quite nicely, yeah. I'm off to Canada next week, so a little bit of that late summer, northern summer will be nice.
Long, long days.
Yes, so we hope, yeah.
You are quite a specialist at travelling light, though, aren't you?
I am. You may have seen, I had a story in The Age, actually in Fairfax Digital, the online version of the travel section a week ago. And aside from detailing my complex rule of three, which ensures that I only ever take cabin luggage with me, I also did a video as well, something I felt I was not used to, sort of being on the other side of the camera, so to speak. I'm used to writing. So they came around to my apartment and filmed me packing. So I thought that was quite quite an interesting challenge.
And I was interested with your rule of three because I have to say I'm another person who likes to travel light. But there were a couple of things that were missing off your travel pack list that, you know, I couldn't possibly leave the house without.
So this is a lady thing?
Earrings. I need to take three pairs of earrings.
Oh, they're small. That would be easy to
They
pack.
Are, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They're very, very small. I'd need to take three necklaces.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've only got one neck.
Oh, I know, but I like to wear things in ensembles.
Ah, the jewelry, ensemble dressing.
The jewelry thing is interesting because people go, what if you want to buy gifts for people when you're travelling, which is, you know, something you do. I always buy jewelry because it's light. Well, I could wear it. It's small, it's light, and it's often something that's made there, you know, so if I'm in Poland, it's amber jewellery. You know,
mm-hmm. Oh, lovely.
And for blokes, you can get tie pins or whatever Cuffing. As well. So there's, so there's
and
choices.
And amber is very light. For those people who don't know, if they have any amber that's heavy, it's not amber.
Yeah, yes, if it's got a mosquito in it with blood, you should give it to Spielberg.
For Jurassic Park, yeah. Jurassic Park 3, 4, whatever it is. But we interviewed a guy 1 year. He worked on an amber stall in Gdansk in Poland. And we interviewed him for a little box text for the Lonely Planet book. Actually, my wife was with me that time, and we actually tracked him down. And he was a great interviewee, and we managed to sort of come up with all the tests for finding out
if real
amber was fake. And he had about three different tests, and one of them was quite daring of getting a, you know, something like a cigarette lighter and, yeah, trying to burn it.
That's right, a hot needle.
Yeah, well, something of that nature, yeah. So it was kind of funny. Actually, I still know that.
So if it burns up, it's real?
I tried to remember what the test was.
If the hot needle will go through the amber and it releases a particular fragrance, then your piece of amber is somewhat stuffed. Yeah. But it was real.
That's it.
Real and ruined.
Real and ruined. And it should be quite light and not cold. A glass would be cold, but amber should be quite warm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, so it was good fun. I still know that guy. I catch up with him for a drink when we go back to Gdansk because I go back to Poland every so often.
So why has Poland got this reputation for being flush with amber?
Oh, it's most of the amber in the world comes from the Baltic. It's washed up from the seabed along the Polish, the Lithuanian, and a bit of the Russian coast. So it's just a place where, in fact, every year they have this festival. I can't remember where it is now, somewhere in Poland, where you go down to the beaches and it's like beachcombing and you try and find amber after a particular stormy part of the year where it's more likely to have been washed up from the seabed.
From where? From the underground
from
forest
the seabed.
Of Jurassic Park?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So how do you get the mosquitoes in there?
Oh, this is
Are these aquatic mosquitoes?
Prehistoric. You know, it used to be on land and now it's on
Furnish me with information.
If anybody has any questions regarding amber,
yes, we're getting into the obscure now.
Email in on onair@joy.org.au.
And maybe come with me to Poland to find out all these answers to these questions. I'm just burning with desire to know about how they get the insects inside the underwater amber.
Well, I think we have some people who are still trying to understand what the rule of three is for packing.
Oh, okay.
So shall we?
Do you want me to?
Yeah, three necklaces.
Yeah, well, basically, to make a long story short, I just, over some years, kept thinking there must be a way of packing lighter than this. You know, when you found yourself, there was one time in Britain where an enormous suitcase that had nowhere to sit but the train seats. There was another time slogging through some humid streets in a hilly place in Italy with too much luggage, and basically boiled it down to, I thought if you had a principle you could base it around, you wouldn't overpack if you knew what you were doing. And so basically sort of, you know, three of certain things, three shirts, you know, three socks, pairs of socks and so on, and then two of something else, one of something else, and basically reducing it to a, you know, a sort of uniform list. But obviously if you're going somewhere with different climates, you might vary the list, but at least it sort of keeps it simple.
So what I understand is we have three shirts, and I like the fact that you're quite specific within that. You said, well, one of them must have a collar,
yep,
which I definitely agree with. Three pairs of socks,
mm-hmm,
three pairs of underwear, two trousers, one being a pair of jeans and one being formal, a pair of bathers, a fleecy top, a scarf, a woolen hat, a jacket and caterpillar boots.
That's pretty well.
I don't see any stilettos in there.
No, I'm not a fan of the stilettos, but yeah.
Right. So we could add a little bit. We could add jewellery, well, and we could add a pair of stilettos and maybe some running gear. I don't
maybe
see
an espadrille.
Any gym gear. I mean, espadrille, yes.
Shoes are the problem. If you want to go cabin luggage, shoes are the problem. The reason I have those caterpillar boots is they're great walking boots. They're black. If you shine them up, they can pass for to go into a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just use that one pair. But obviously anything that's sort of collapsible, like, I don't know, deck shoes or something that you could pack,
yep,
you know, thongs, whatever. You could obviously vary. It's when I go to Thailand, there's no fleecy in that packing, obviously. You know it's going to be warm.
Yeah. So you're just a casual sarong.
Yeah, so you've got more space, basically, yeah.
David Beckham style.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's weird. I've been to Europe for 8 weeks with that one bag, and I've gone away for 3 days somewhere and had the same bag, and it always seems to be full. And you think if you're going away 3 days, you could do really light, but somehow you always seem to find things to fill the bag.
Well, look, it's very true, and I find that if I'm travelling on my own and I suddenly have that whole 30-kilo luggage allowance, it's so tempting to add a couple of extra outfits just in case I change my mind. So it's a good discipline to have to just go cabin luggage.
But you're also a person who dresses in ensembles, as you said before, and you have like a wing at home, which is wardrobe.
And shoes.
I do, but my rule of travel is that my equivalent to the rule of three is I actually take that to colour. So I will pick three colours. So, for example, black, white with a dash of red.
Right.
And everything has to fall within that spectrum.
Sure.
And that's the way that I cope.
So you Chanel it up.
I do like to Chanel. And I wear all of the jewellery on the plane, which, of course, can be a little bit of a problem when you're going through security because
like
I do have to take it all off. But it's the weight that I'm concerned about. So Yeah, if I wear all of my jet and my vintage crystals, then it's better than putting it in luggage.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where the fleecy is brilliant, is it's so light and yet just allows you to do layers on a cold morning, and it might be hot later on and you can just do the layer thing. Yeah, it's really good. I think, too, it depends how formal your trip is. If you know that you're just going to be doing stuff where jeans and a T-shirt is fine, then you don't have so much to pack. If you know you're going to be going to the opera and meeting someone at the embassy or whatever, then you, obviously it's a different story. But, yeah, often you can...
Yeah, travelling with suiting is a different story. Tell us about that.
Say that again, sorry.
Travelling with suiting.
Suiting.
With the suits.
Oh, the suits, yeah. I was up at a conference in Sydney last week, but it wasn't formal enough for... suits. I have done that, but it's usually a really short trip, so you can wear the suit on the plane, I find, is probably better, so that everything else that can be crumpled is in the bag. You know?
Yeah, it depends how long haul, I guess. I tend to try and take a jacket and have them hang it up if possible, because the jacket's the hard bit. You can roll up a pair of trousers and steam them out pretty easy. Mm. So, now, steaming things out, what's the easiest way? Just hanging in the shower, turn on the hot, screw the environment?
I mean, obviously with this, you know, this little luggage, sometimes you're going to be, well, obviously you're going to be washing things fairly often. That's the one drawback of travelling this light. And, yeah, you will be occasionally when you're stuck washing things in the sink and I guess hanging. Sometimes you get those European hotels that have the little.
Yep.
You seen those little washing line?
Most hotels
retract?
Have them.
Yeah. Yeah, those are quite good.
It looks like a garrote.
Yeah, that's right. It looks like someone, James Bond film, should be doing something evil with it. But yeah, that's a good way around it. I mean, when I'm in, I go to Poland for Lonely Planet and I occasionally will hire an apartment there rather than getting a hotel room. It's about the same price. You have a washing machine and off you go. And there's been times when I've just been walking around inside the apartment just wearing the formal trousers and a duvet wrapped around me because every other thing is in the wash and they've got to dry out overnight or else I can't do anything the following day. But, you know, in summer you can get away with it.
Yeah, it's a bit like that story when those of us always get locked out of a hotel room when we're just wearing the kimono.
In the nude.
Yes,
that happens all the time.
That's right. Yeah.
We've all been there.
Multiple times, absolutely.
What happened in Vegas, Joe? It stays in Vegas.
I've just been to Vegas,
it
too.
Does. Yeah. It does. We've got Tim Richards, the very accomplished travel writer, who's just been telling us how to pack. So if anybody has their own theory on the way that they like to pack to travel light, feel free to SMS us on 0427JOY949 or email us at onair@joy.org.au.
And become a member. How do people do that, Joe?
What happens is you give Anthony a call, who is our receptionist on 1-300-JOY-949.
And he's braced, teeth gritted, waiting for the onslaught of phone calls.
Yeah, and you just give Anthony your credit card details.
Because it's next to nothing to become a member, isn't it? Oh, but you get everything.
It's from $36.
Possibly
imagine.
It's
even less.
A sticker.
Well, and your dog.
A membership card.
Your pets can become members.
Yeah, they can.
Yeah. We're not at all like a political party. Anyone can vote.
Oh.
No, I just thought I'd add that little election theme in. Anyone was, you know, not over
tired
elections.
Tired of it. It's so tired already. Every time I turn around, I see those two gawping white men. Everywhere you go. Can't get rid of it. Although I would like to travel out of Australia right now and just post my vote back and then come back when all the dust has settled in 4 or 5 years.
Well, I have to say I was very quick off the mark. As soon as I received the Electoral Commission information, I have shot it straight back to them requesting a postal vote.
Oh,
because
good.
I simply don't have time on a Saturday to stand in line and vote.
I'm early voting next week. I'm going to be in Canada on the election, so that'll be nice. I get to miss quite a chunk of it.
So good. I'll come with you. Can you pack me in your hand luggage?
Check you a bit. You can carry my bags.
Tim, you mentioned earlier that one of the subjects that you write a lot for Lonely Planet on is Poland.
Yeah.
What is your connection to Poland?
It's not a family connection, so that's sort of the logical thing that it would be, but it's not.
Sure.
In the 90s, I taught English for 2 years with a company called International House. It's a worldwide organisation based in Britain. And they recruit, you know, English teachers for their schools that are affiliated all around the world. So it was 2 years in their school in Egypt, in Cairo. And then we transferred to the school in Krakow in Poland because it was at that time it wasn't that long since the fall of the regimes and English was in big demand. So I lived in Poland for about sort of a bit less than a year. And
what was the culture shock like going from Egypt, which is quite a very distinct culture, even within the Arab world?
Very lively, yes.
Yeah. Very fertile. And then plonking right into the middle of pretty industrial Poland, right?
Krakow. Oh, well, Krakow's a beautiful city. Mm. And this
huge
is
huge history and amazing landscape, but also quite industrial,
but
right?
Not so much Krakow. To the west, in the coal area, near around Katowice, that is industrial. But this is something I find that even over 20 years after the wall has fallen, people in Australia still see that part of Europe as tractor factories and so on. And all the old communist, cliches.
Yeah, all communists drink vodka.
Yeah, that's right. There was plenty of vodka there. But it's a beautiful city. It was the royal capital for many centuries. Mm-hmm. It thankfully escaped destruction of any major sort in World War II. And no one's ever been quite able to figure out why. Sometimes it's like, there was a sudden flanking movement by the Red Army and the Nazis didn't get a chance to blow up the city like they did with Warsaw or whatever. But it's a beautiful city and it really does have the centuries there.
Hitler had a grand plan of keeping some cities intact, like Oxford and some of the Polish cities that he didn't want bombed.
Yeah.
So unless they were strategically important, he wanted to keep the history there because that was considered a part of Deutsche Lebensraum.
There has been a lot of, Poland nowadays is quite homogenous in sense of ethnicity and religion and so on. But for many centuries, it was very mixed. A lot of German speakers and Russian speakers, as well as Poles and everyone
Poison.
Else.
Yeah, that's my heritage is from that area.
It's a beautiful city. It was lovely to live there. But, of course, this was only a few years after the communist regime had fallen and enormous changes. And you felt you could just see this incredible changes happening around you. And it was very hard, for example, for people who were elderly and retired, because young people had a chance, in a sense, under the new system or new economy to perhaps succeed. But if you were on the pension, state pension, and prices were rising around you, it could be a hard time, even though you had your freedom now. But going back, 11 years later, I went back as a Lonely Planet writer, and 11 years was like a century. It was the place has really progressed, and it's been such a pleasure visiting places like Warsaw, which can be hard work sometimes, a city like that.
Why is that?
Oh, it just Warsaw was so destroyed that there was a lot of rebuilding after the war, a lot of unsympathetic concrete. So when you come out of...
Unsympathetic is a very tactful word.
When you come out of Warszawa Centralna, which is the main train station, which is a 1975, communist icon, you come out of there and you cross the street to catch a bus, and it's just concrete chaos, kind of like, well, what is this place? But it's got such a beautiful old town, which was built absolutely from scratch in the 50s from the ruins, which you would think had been there centuries. And it's a vibey city. I mean, in a way, that kind of strange mix of architecture has given rise to, good bars and nice dining and a bit of energy. And they've done the place up beautifully in the last sort of 20 years.
And for a long time, there weren't very many people from outside of Poland in Poland. There were some Vietnamese, there were some Russians, there were some Germans. So foreigners would have been quite a novelty at that stage when you first went there.
Yes, I think by that point, Krakow was already a bit of a tourist hub. So it happened very quickly there with backpackers and so on. Mm-hmm. But in general, but now it is more cosmopolitan, excuse me. Especially the big cities, Warsaw, Gdansk, Krakow. If you go out to the countryside, though, you'll still find some little towns that feel like they're a few centuries back. But the place
which is amazing,
more,
and that needs to be cherished to a degree, don't you think?
Yeah, well, it's they call the Poles talk about Poland A and Poland B, and they mean, and they often, it's not precise, but sometimes it's west versus east. It's sort of sense there's a Poland which is more industrialized and modern and cosmopolitan, and there's a Poland which is more religious and traditional and more agricultural, and that's often in the east part. But those are beautiful places. There's a lovely city called Lublin in the southeast, which international tourists don't often visit, which is just as attractive as Krakow and has, a castle and beautiful streetscapes. And I really like visiting there, and it is more relaxed. There's a slower pace. It's nice.
And obviously, Tim, how many times have you been to Poland?
Oh, I'm just trying to think now. I've been back about half a dozen times since 2006, and I lived there, obviously, originally. So I'm starting to know the place better. There's a transition between it being foreign. And like when I go to Warsaw, I have my favourite bars and I have my favourite restaurants. And, you go to this particular cafe in the train station when you're waiting for a train. So you start to sort of feel a bit like a local, but you're not quite there yet, which is kind of nice.
You obviously do then have a routine for each time that you revisit now.
Yeah. There's two books that Poland appears in, as far as Lonely Planet goes, which is the Eastern Europe book, which is one of those big, thick books with many countries. And there's the Poland book, which is specifically that country. And that one has much more detail. So when we do the Poland book, we usually split it up amongst three all four authors, and we all take a region or two each. When we do Eastern Europe, I do the whole country, and it's sort of the highlight. It's the major cities and some of the country areas that stand out. So I do get to know them quite well. You know, I've been to Gdansk every single time, for example. I'm getting to know that city quite well.
And in addition to writing for The Lonely Planet, you've written your own book, We Have Here the Homicide, yeah. which is quite a tongue twister of a title. Tell us a little bit about the book and what inspired you to write it.
This is going to sound nuts, but it's true. I can show you some documentation.
It's okay. We're not Homeland Security.
I'm just talking to the listeners now. But when we were there in 90, we lived there in 94, 95, and we lived in a converted old house that was at two levels that was split into two apartments, basically. And we were upstairs. And one evening we came back from, we were teaching and we were there late at night. Usually you'd come back after the late class at 9 p.m. or whatever. And we came back to see police cars outside. And, oh, interesting. Oh, well, okay, walk up the stairs. Halfway up on the landing to the first apartment, we look in the door. There's a policeman who stops us and we look past him and see the, you know, naked dead body of the landlord.
The landlord's, oh my.
Yeah, because there was an old man who lived there. He was the landlord's father, but there was the landlord. And we went, oh, that's interesting. And at which point the guy realised we spoke English and said, he says, no, no, you can't go up. We have here the homicide. So, which, of
all
course,
of it.
Being a writer, you have two reactions. You've got your visceral there on the spot, shocked, horrified reaction. And there's this little part of your brain that hovers up here above your head, which is observing more detached, in a more detached manner.
In the spirit of Balzac or Flaubert,
yes.
The observer.
Which goes, this is going to be interesting, a story one day. And here I am talking about it yet again on radio many, many years later. But that was, you know, it was a strange period of transition. There was, who knows? We got interviewed at the police station. That was quite exciting because they had to get a translator in. And we knew nothing. We're the most ignorant, hopeless witnesses ever. You know, we would never get on a crime show.
So he rocked up, he was dead and naked, that's it.
Yeah, and did you notice people coming and going, yeah, on and off? Did you notice any cars, what they were? Nah, you know, like we were hopeless.
They were all Trabants, weren't they?
Yeah, we were
hopeless. State-made car, all of them.
But
all
I mean,
of them.
It is such a contrast between then and when I go to Krakow now, which is such a beautiful, modern, cosmopolitan, open,
and affluent
place, you know. And yeah, I mean, the economy's done well. They get caught up in the problems that Europe is having. Mm. But their banks didn't collapse during the GFC. They were pretty solid. Some cities have done better than others. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some cities that had industries that haven't prospered. So you still will find there's a lot of... It's a big country. There's a lot of infrastructure to make up. There's a lot of EU funding going into that. So every so often I'll see new trains or new railways. The big cities have tourist money that can go into it, you know. So it's a great country to visit. I really recommend people to see part of that Central and Eastern Europe. If you've already seen Western Europe, it's a great contrast.
You're on Joy 94.9 in the Escape Pod with myself, Jo Pryor, Mark Adams, and our special guest today, Tim Richards. So, Tim, tell us a little bit about some recent journeys that you had to both Jordan in the Middle East and also the city that never sleeps, Vegas.
Yeah, they're a bit of a contrast, aren't they? There we are.
No, they're both in the desert.
Well, actually, good point. There is something similar. Yeah, we...
desert straws.
I just give you some of the idea of how travel writing can work. The sort of behind-the-scenes stuff is that about 23 Australian journalists were hosted by the Jordan Tourism Board back in March. And that's a really big media trip. Normally, they're like five journalists in a minibus kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a big for mil.
Yeah, it was. It was huge. And so we went over. And I think the penny has dropped. I found this too, not just with Jordan, but I went to a big lunch of South American travel reps here in Melbourne. There's a bunch of these far-flung countries that are a long way from Australia have just suddenly gone, these Australians, they travel a lot, don't they? And they travel for longer than anyone else, and they spend more than anyone else, and their economy is okay. So maybe we should try and get them. And because, you know, the economy in, you know, the US and in Europe has been poor, so therefore they've been losing out on visitors from those traditional places. So,
and it's also because Australians are transited from going through Asia to Europe through the Middle East,
absolutely,
particularly Dubai and Abu Dhabi. Yeah.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah. And so we went on Etihad and we transferred Abu Dhabi into Jordan. So it's a fairly, you know, as direct as you can get. And it's a look, I've been there, and it's just weird going back to places I haven't been. I was previously 19 years ago when I lived in Egypt. And it was amazing to get back there. And I love the Middle East. I love the the Arab hospitality. I love the food. I go there and I think, why do I not eat this food all the time in Melbourne? You know, and
why don't you?
I don't know. I mean, I should. There's some great Middle Eastern restaurants
here. There's an excellent place you can go to learn how to do that. Oasis Bakery in Murrumbina.
Oh, people always tell me about that. Yeah,
the woman who runs it is an amazing woman. We want to get her on to talk about what you can do to have a Lebanese experience because we talk about around the world in 80 minutes, and that's just a trip to Murrumbina away, and it's a fantastic experience. Lovely.
And you know what's close to that bakery, don't you?
No.
One of Melbourne's best European shoe warehouses.
Oh, Louisa.
Yeah,
yeah. Don't you could get them. Yourself into some foreign clompers in no time.
Yeah, don't pack them, though. But no, I must talk up Petra, because obviously Egypt at the moment is problematic, to put it mildly, but which is terrible. I feel heartbroken about it, because it's such a beautiful country and such an amazing country. But I must say, if you're going to the Middle East, Jordan is a great country. It's moderate, stable. Mm-hmm. Petra is the equal of the pyramids. It is a fantastic site.
You reckon?
It is fantastic. It's so complex. You could spend days there.
Mm. And you walk through the Sikh, and that's the interesting thing.
Yes, it's this wonderful canyon you walk through for a couple of kilometres, which is enormously dramatic. Then you come out in front of the Treasury Building, which was used in one of the Indiana Jones movies. Mm. And but there's such a complex site. There's high places, low places, far-flung places.
But walking through the Sikh and then seeing Al-Khazneh for the first time is very
great experience.
Impressive.
And I don't know if you know, there's a new experience called Petra by Night, and we went on it last year, and it's about once or twice a week. Normally it's not accessible at night, and they put candles all the way down the canyon, down the Sikh, to the Treasury, and they have put mats out there. So the idea is you walk down by candlelight. It's beautiful.
Oh, that would be
shadows.
Amazing.
Yeah, and there's a bit of music going on. You walk all the way down, and then you sit on this matting in front of the Treasury, and they put on some performances. There's people playing the flute and traditional instruments and so on. And so that you don't get any further than that. But it's a great sort of introduction to the place.
They still have the Donkeys of Death?
Oh, the donkeys, yes.
It's quite a walk. I'd say about 2 kilometres.
A couple of kilometres
through the Sikh before you even get to
Al-Khazneh. It's reasonably steep if you're going back too, because it's
So you can get on these traditional style donkeys with a thing at the back which has wheels. I really don't want to call it.
Well, they're
a
really these horses. They're like little horses and cart type things. Yeah,
but quite often they'll stick a BMW logo on the head of the donkey and. put the price up when you're going in, because it's so you're exhausted by the time you go through it all, because it's quite extensive.
Oh, when you
it?
coming back is when you're really exhausted. But actually, they have. I was interested. They have actually regulated the whole horse and carriage thing.
Okay.
They seem to be more under control at the moment. The prices went up quite a lot a couple of years ago, the Jordanian government, but the trade-off was that they could then put the money into the site, and it seems better organised now. And even when you're inside the site, you will get hassled a little bit by people wanting to sell you postcards or wanting to do a donkey ride. But if you say no thanks, they'll stop, which is not what you get at the pyramids.
Oh, God, no. Egypt is a different level, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's the most outstanding experience you had there?
Oh, of general
being
hassle.
Badgered.
Well, when we lived there, of course, after a while, you'd learn a bit of Arabic. And so I could say to them, I'd say, no papyrus, I've got a room full of it at home. And they'd laugh. Or I'd say, no papyrus, thanks, I'm an English teacher, I haven't got any money. And and once they sort of realised, you live here, then they would not hassle you. And you could speak a little about Arabic. So, I mean, it's a good reason to learn a language in any country, isn't it? Just because you'll be given a bit more slack. You know?
Yeah, there are a few countries where people are incredibly motivated to separate you from what's in your pocket.
I must say with Cairo, that the key to be, everyone would travel there. Tourists would only be in Egypt for a week, and they would, you know, they would only go to the major tourist sites. If you only go to the major tourist sites, you're going to get a bit of tout hassle, right? But the key to Cairo was, I mean, those are great sites, but you could get away and see all sorts of wonderful little palaces and museums that tourists never went to, where you wouldn't find tons of tourists.
What would you recommend?
I'm trying to think. There was an insane, I don't know if it's still there, there was a railway museum at the main train station which had wonderful old royal carriages and things.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, and I'm trying to think, there was a Manuel Palace. It was an old palace on an island in the Nile which wasn't as visited again. And I think there was actually a hotel there, so you could even visit the palace but also go for a swim, you know, at the pool.
Yeah,
and so
you could have accommodation.
Yeah, yeah. So there are little museums, and sometimes they have been museums that have hung around since colonial times or whatever and have just kind of been maintained but don't have a lot of tourists. When you're in the bazaars area, which is the Khan Khalili, everyone tends to go to the tourist section, and you buy, you know, carpets and all that sort of stuff. But you head south, you just keep walking. It's this enormous suburb of it really is like from the movies, you know, the tiny alleyways, the little ancient doors and shops. And you can walk down to the tent maker's bazaar and buy cloth. But then we're talking about a place which at the moment is a bit problematic to travel to. But Jordan,
when I was in the Khan al-Khalili, we left 30 minutes before a terrorist bomb took the lives of a bunch of French school children. Okay. So, yeah, you've got to be very mindful wherever you are in Egypt.
Sure.
And it's all the time. Yeah. Right? And that's one of the challenges with Egypt. Yeah. It's got so much to offer.
Yeah. I mean, we'll come back. I mean, Syria is a heartbreak. And I traveled there when I was... And that was a lovely country to travel to. But, I mean, I would say, Jordan, I would certainly give that the plus at the moment. It seemed very moderate and safe to me.
Did you also go to Israel from there?
No, but you can do. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes the Israelis will do a day trip down to Petra and back. So, I mean, people do that. We stayed in the Dead Sea at the end. There's a whole a sort of resort area that's popped up the north end of the Dead Sea, where there isn't really a town. It's kind of just, you know, planted itself on the banks. And we're at the Kempinski, which is quite a flash one, and arrived there in my boots covered with dust from Petra, in the foyer of this beautiful hotel with someone playing the piano dressed like she was from Mad Men. And you came, oh God, I'm so embarrassed.
And you wished you had have bought a pair of earrings.
Well, that's right. Why didn't I have my earrings on? But it's amazing because you go down to that, you can go right. There's pools and all the usual resort stuff, but you go all the way down to the rocky shore. You can just bob around in the Dead Sea, and it really is that insane flotation. This very bitter, salty water, and this it's hard to even turn over in the water. It's so buoyant.
It is,
and there's the weird mud you smear yourself with. The whole thing. So I thought that was a great experience. It was a good experience to do after you'd been in the desert doing all this out at Wadi Rum, out in the desert, and seeing Petra. To end up in one of these resorts was a nice way of ending.
And just near there did you see Lot's wife?
The pillar. Yes, we did. We were below. We were kind of on the highway below, looking up. Yeah,
I think it's just some pillar. They call it Lot's wife. They said this is the pillar that when Lot's wife turned her back to look at the destruction of Sodom, she was turned into a pillar of salt. And there it is. Although it's a pillar of rocks.
Helen of Troy.
We were down at Wadi Rum outside Aqaba, and if you're familiar with Lawrence of Arabia, that was quite a few. Look, a lot of those scenes were filmed there. And so amazing rock formations, desert environment. And, you know, some of the guides, the local Bedouin, have this business where they take you out in four-wheel drives and you're tearing through the desert and checking it out. And they're pointing to one rock formation saying, that's called the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Because it's just named after the name of T. Lawrence's book, you know. So they've kind of pasted that in. Because it's nice, rocky, you know, seven pillars kind of.
It's like a Disney experience, Bedouin style.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but everyone goes, ooh, and gets out their iPhone.
I must say it is fun, though, because you're out on these four-wheel drives just tearing through these desert tracks. It's not like it's, sealed. And every so often you end up at a tent where you can sort of buy a drink and buy some souvenirs, and off you go again. And it's quite good fun. But it's a small country, too, so it's easy to to cover the ground, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, I think you might have inspired some people to add not only Poland to the next destination list, but also Jordan. You're back in the escape pod with Mark Adams, Joe Pryor, and our special guest today, Tim Richards. We've just been speaking about travels and we've touched on things like famils, which I guess are considered to be the perks of the trade in one sense, but of course without being on the ground you can't possibly write about it. But Tim, you've been a travel writer for quite some time. What do you see as some of the challenges to actually make your career a sustainable one that is viable for you to pay the light bill?
Yeah, that's the trick. I mean, it all sounds glamorous, you know, like people think you're going to be lying on the beach drinking cocktails, but of course, like, for example, with the Lonely Planet work, you know, you're actually rushing around town with a clipboard, making notes and getting on the train to the next place and so on. So it is work, but you know, it's great work to have. It's stimulating and I get to work for myself, which is great. But I've been doing it for almost 10 years as a freelance journalist slash travel writer. And I do other sorts of writing too. I do a bit of Age, a bit of arts writing for the Age, a bit of comedy festival reviewing, that kind of thing.
How does it vary between publications when you write about travel? Do they vary greatly in what you need to be mindful of when you're travelling and what you need to express, more experiential, more technical?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. You need to know the market. Each magazine is different. I just had a piece in Backpacker Essentials, so that's a young audience. So
you're talking about the Four Seasons and having $300 mud wraps.
Sure. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, obviously, and obviously mainstream publications are different. Some newspapers have a different market to others. When you're pitching to them, that's kind of when you're most conscious of that, I suppose. You're making sure you're pitching them something that suits them. I was just pitching something to a budget airline magazine recently, and you know, you had to just be mindful of things that fit that audience. Yeah, pitching something about expensive, you know, menswear stores or something isn't going to work. But you know, something that is cheap and cheerful probably will. I say almost 10 years, but I mean, really, it's the same predicament the newspapers are in. That say companies that do guidebooks, newspapers obviously have this predicament that the internet is completely changing the models of how you source income as a publication. Mm-hmm. That feeds into how many staff you can afford. Sometimes that's good for freelancers, because if there's fewer staffers on a newspaper, they might need freelancers more. But sometimes it's bad because they find cheap ways of sourcing material from feeds. Yep.
That was the next question. Can you put out a press release talking about, or can you communicate that you've written a story about a particular country that might be fashionable at the moment, or might be a reason that people want to buy your story, and different publications will buy it but commission you to restructure it differently? Does that work?
They wouldn't. The editors are too busy to look at that stuff. But if I would pitch it to them individually. I do it by email. You know, you will send a pitch to this editor saying, here's a story I've just researched. This is why it would work for your audience. So really it has to be individually pitched to that editor. Okay. That's the only way it really can work.
Right.
So because it's a buyer's market from their point of view. You know, it's enormously competitive.
Yeah,
even as someone's been doing it for 10 years, I still have to struggle to get them to open my email to some degree. You know, it's not that easy.
Well,
know,
who pays for all your travel costs then?
It's a mix. Sometimes I pay for myself and I'm hopeful of, you know, selling
and
enough stories.
And then you try to recoup it through.
Yeah, that's all right, for selling enough stories.
So you take the risk up front?
Sometimes. Sometimes with a Lonely Planet job, you're paid a fee, which is quite arcane the way it's calculated, but basically it's meant to cover all your expenses and a certain profit per week. So, and I usually found that's worked out okay with Lonely Planet. And then if I'm going to, say, Poland for Lonely Planet, I will add on a few weeks, go to some neighbouring countries once I finish the Lonely Planet job. Like last year, I went to Sweden, Czech Republic, UK, as well as Poland, and then build up lots of research material I can then use to sell stories to various publications over the course of the year, for example. And in other times, I'm hosted by tourism bodies, and you know, I'm always very frank about that in stories. I always say, you know, the bottom, it's Tim Richards was travel courtesy of the Jordan Tourism Board, right? So, I mean, from my point of view, it's necessary evil. I'd rather, in a sense, the publication's paid all my costs, but it's a bit like a motoring journalist being lent the car to review. It's like I'm being given access, and I try to be as neutral and as unbiased as I can.
Well, it obviously works, because Mossy, one of our listeners, has just emailed in to say that he's been listening about the Middle East. He was in Cairo in the 80s, and it was fantastic, and stayed at the El Gazira Hotel on the island in the Nile.
Yeah.
So
fantastic.
People definitely are reading what travel writers produce. Mm. Do you find that it's often a situation where you're pitching as opposed to you're being invited to write?
I see what you mean. Yes, no, occasionally, like I said, it's a buyer's market. So it's much more me trying to convince an editor, hey, this is a great story. I think your readers would like it because of this. Would you like me to write it up? That's much more the common experience. But sometimes an editor will give me a call. A couple of months ago, there's a series in The Age at the moment in conjunction with Tourism Victoria called Spotted by Locals.
Yes.
Where a celeb goes back to his or her hometown in Victoria.
Oh, yes. You did one with Strictly Ballroom.
I did Paul
Mercurio.
Yes. Yeah, it was great. And I did that.
For real?
Yeah, we flew up to Mildura. Me and the film guy, we did a road trip. We were in a separate car and we're going from Swan Hill to Mildura with Paul Mercurio and his other half. And that was great. I mean, he's a really professional guy and you just don't know what it'd be like to work with this guy, because the filming takes up so much time. I had to kind of buttonhole him and say, oh, can you quickly tell me something about that olive oil we just tasted, you know? And but he was great. He was really professional, so it actually made it really easy, and it was an interesting, you know, day out. And then I got to kill another day in Mildura where I hadn't been before, and went looking for stories to sell to someone else as well. So that was good, where I got invited, and that's partly building up trust over years, that the editors know you and feel, okay, this guy, as a freelancer, you have to be super on the ball and trustworthy. And I always say my prime mission is to make editors' lives easier, you know. And so if they see you like that, then you will get invited to do stuff, which is nice.
And earlier I heard you mention the S word, Sweden. What were you doing up in Sweden?
Oh, this is one of my little side trips from Poland. So I took a quick short break from the Lonely Planet job. I flew up from Gdansk to Stockholm. I was there 5 days, flew back down to Poland to complete the Lonely Planet work. And I was expecting Sweden to be expensive. That was the image we all have from years and years ago. And this was last year when the dollar was absolutely at its height. This was about June. Mm. And I arrived there and I kind of went, I was staying in this slightly cool, you know, it was like used to be industrial, now, you know, gentrified, cool bar area. So I went to one of these cool bars. I looked
up. You
were
in Gertrude Street, weren't you?
Yeah, that's the kind
of vibe, actually. Yeah, it was the Swedish version of Gertrude Street. But it's Södermalm, which is actually where partly where the Stieg Larsson books are set.
Anyway, so it's a bit edgy.
Yeah, it is a bit edgy, absolutely. Bit of, and I went down there and I got, you know, something to eat, something to drink, kind of got the bill. I was bracing myself. Calculation, hang on, it's about the same as it'd be in Melbourne. And all week, prices were like Sydney and Melbourne. They weren't cheap, but they weren't outrageous either. And I thought, that's just a function of the dollar being so strong, because it was buying 7 Swedish krona a few years before it'd been buying 5, and that would have been expensive.
And yeah. Tell me, the Stieg Larsson tour, I mean, it was for people who may not be aware, when Stieg Larsson died, the lady who his partner, his de facto partner, under Swedish law, didn't get any access to any of the assets in the estate. So is this tour something that she has put on, or is this something that his father and brother are profiting from?
No, this is actually the city.
Oh, right.
So the City Tourism Board. I think what happened is they're not, I mean, I think they were just being proactive or reactive.
You're going to take that duck.
Yeah, well, people showed up saying, where can I see the Stieg Larsson stuff? And where can I see stuff about ABBA? Right.
Oh,
so
well,
in the last 2 years, they've come up with both tours. And I went on both these tours, the ABBA
can
tour.
Can you combine them?
And the Stieg Larsson. Oh, it's a scary thought. We went
so
past,
this is Stieg Larsson's Waterloo right here.
We actually went right past the Hotel Rival, which Benny Andersson owns, on the Stieg Larsson tour. So we did have an ABBA.
So between ABBA, Stieg Larsson, and IKEA and Volvo.
I went to the biggest IKEA in the world. That was
in a Volvo?
No, I didn't. I missed out on that bit.
Because they are just mushing their commercial interests together in Sweden, aren't they?
It was fun, though. The Swedes, this is obvious, but if you've met Swedes, they speak English so well.
Beautifully.
But it's kind of nuts when you're there, because you're like, even, it doesn't matter what job they're in. IKEA, I wanted to see where the IKEA called what they called Swedish meatballs, because obviously they weren't going to be called Swedish meatballs. So I went to the cafe there, ordered something. Oh, it's licensed too. You can get a Danish beer. It was very nice. But even the lady serving behind the counter could speak perfect English. It was just insane how well. And I found this great this van outside one of the stations that serves herring burgers.
So you're saying they have food trucks with sliders as well?
Herring burgers, yeah.
Can you hold that thought? We need to hear all about these herring burgers very soon. Joy 94.9.
Earlier this year, and as we all know, we love Eurovision in the escape
pod. And Armenia.
And Armenia, yes.
Who doesn't love an Armenian?
That's two ticks. So, Tim, the hour's nearly up, but before you go, we were talking earlier about how viable it is to be a travel writer, and that's as a full-time occupation. What are some of the other arrows to your bow, to your quiver that you've had to add to actually make, you know, a full-time career?
Cool. I mean, the great thing is with technology, even though it's challenging the print, the publishing environment, it's also helping in some ways. My website is iWriter, that's a letter I followed by writer.com.au. So at iwriter.com.au, I've got a whole a stack of links to this weird little empire I have online, where I have some e-books I've released, some are travel-related. Some of those are like collecting articles that I still have copyright for that I could rewrite and make a Kindle e-book out of.
Lovely, yeah.
Which would be nice for people who are, say, planning travel. It's not so much the practical stuff, more the atmosphere, the mood, you know.
Yes.
I have three apps I've released. One's Melbourne Historical. Which is lots of quirky little things around Melbourne that you would never notice on the streets.
So something that would be great to have when you're hosting visitors to the city?
I think it would be great. I mean, I get a lot of locals buying it, enjoying it, but a lot of people who are visiting would buy it as well. Melbourne Historical. I've got one called Melbourne Getaways, which is a lot of countryside stuff within 3 hours of Melbourne. And I have Australia by Rail, which is lots of tourist railways and rail-related attractions as well. And I have a blog I do every week called Aero Haveno, which you can find from my iwriter.com.au site, which is it's actually the Esperanto word for airport. I was trying to find something that no one else had used, which was quite good. In a way, you've got other ways of possibly making income, although, as we all know, it's still a challenge to make income from anything digital.
It's an awful lot of apps you have to sell, isn't it, to be able to buy a coffee?
Ironically, the ones I've sold the most of are the ones that have got reported on in print publications. So there you go.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for being our guest this week in the Escape Pod. Really appreciate you coming in. Mark, it's time for us to go. I'm going fly fishing.
Are you?
I am. I'm about to go French nymphing.
You're the Lord of the Fly Fisherman. Lordess? Lady?
Lady.
Lady Fly?
Lady of the Fly.
Lady Gaga's got a new album coming out. We're going to trend into that, or just Gay Station of the Nation. Joy 94.9. Thanks for joining us on Escape Pod.
Indeed. Ciao for now.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with Joy.